Thank you. We're joined, as usual, by Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, Rhode Island.
And University of Rhode Island political science professor Maureen Moakley. Good morning, Maureen.
Good morning, everyone.
We're pleased to welcome back as our special guest, Congressman David Cicilline of the 1st Congressional District. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Americans say they hate hyperpartisanship, yet Congress keeps moving from one budget crisis to the next. As a result of the across-the-board spending cuts known as the sequester, Rhode Islanders getting unemployment benefits will see a cut in those benefits later this month. Congressman, what will it take for Congress to move beyond these kind of serial budget crises?
I think it's going to take a continuing effort to reach some common ground and understand that government has important functions that we need to invest in. Education, rebuilding the infrastructure of our country, and investing in science and research, job training, the things that are necessary to grow the economy and get people back to work. And we have got to somehow persuade this very far right of the Republican caucus, led by the Tea Party, who are committed to just cutting at all the costs, sort of no matter what. We've done a very substantial amount of deficit reduction, about $2.4 trillion over the next decade, a combination of cuts in spending and the generation of new revenues. We have to do more of that, but I think, as the president said, we have to do it in a balanced way.
Part of the issue with that Tea Party cohort is that those representatives are more concerned about a challenge from the right than they are interested in collaborating with their colleagues across the aisle. How do you see that panning out, Maureen?
Well, my point here is, do the Democrats get the fact that we all thought that the GOP was going to get blamed for these cuts? Now, I mean, you're all being blamed. I mean, this isn't a partisan issue anymore. It looks like, you know, you could say it's the Tea Party's fault, but it really, people look at Congress and say, this is just unacceptable.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right.
And you all suffer.
No, I don't think there's any question about it. I don't think anybody believes that, you know, there, at least I don't believe there makes any sense in spending a lot of time trying to assign blame. I think what we need to do is find solutions to this. I mean, I've become very involved as a founding member of this organization called No Labels, which is really committed to problem solving. It's 20 Democrats, 20 Republicans, one independent, Angus King from Maine. We meet every week, and it's really designed to try to bring people together to figure out, can we find some common ground? Because I think you're right. It's not a question of, you know, people don't have time to figure out who to blame. They want solutions. They want answers. So I think you're absolutely right.
Where do you see the common ground, Scott?
I don't see very much. Frankly, on just about every tough issue, the country is very polarized. And you see this not just in the Congress, but with the voters. You know, somebody put these people here. And given the way that districts are gerrymandered, I hate to say this, but a lot of Republicans come from an older America. They're white, they're Southern, they're from very safe districts with very little diversity. So I think there's a problem. Also, how do you make a deal on the fiscal cliff's a good example. How do you make a deal with a House caucus on the Republican side where the Speaker votes one way and his majority leader, Eric Cantor from Virginia, votes the other way? I mean, that's, you know, a House caucus divided against itself can't stand.
Thank you, Mr. Lincoln. Let's go to some questions for our special guest, Congressman Cicilline. Congressman, you're obviously the former mayor of Providence, and there's a lot of concern about the future of the now vacant Superman building in downtown. There's a proposal afoot to try and change that into residential units with about $48 million in tax credits. Do you support that idea?
I think it's very important that that building be occupied and developed. I don't know that tax credits is the right way to do it. I think you have to look at, and that's a targeted investment that would go to the benefit of a single property owner. I think that's something, if there were reinstatement of the historic tax credits, it seems to me that would be a good public policy. I don't know enough about the particular proposal, but I think we have to be very careful about a proposal that would be a benefit to a single property owner. I don't think that's the way we should be approaching this.
Let's go to Scott.
You know, there's a lot of talk about Mayor Angel Taveras running for governor, and I was a little surprised to find out that you have been urging Speaker Gordon Fox to run for mayor if the current mayor runs for governor.
I'm a huge fan of the Speaker. I think if he decided to run for mayor, he would be terrific. I think this is all getting way ahead of itself. I don't think there's been a decision made, at least that we've heard of, from the current mayor, who is doing obviously a great job. So, but I think Speaker Fox is talented and smart, and I think he'd do a great job. But obviously, he'll make a decision But as I said, I think we're getting way ahead of ourselves. I'm not sure that there's
Yeah, but if we're getting ahead of ourselves, why have you called Gordon Fox and urged him to run?
No, I haven't called him. Look, Gordon's my friend. I've told him on many occasions that I think he'd be a great mayor. I don't know that he has any interest in it at all, but I think he has skills that would make him a terrific mayor.
Let's go to Maureen.
I want to go back to the national level. I generally understand where you're coming from, and I appreciate the fact that you are trying to make these policy decisions from a consensual point of view. The one thing that I can't get in terms of your position is the one on Social Security, the idea that you seem to reject the notion that we really have to reform this, we really have to change the benefit structure.
No, I don't reject that we have to reform it. What I reject is that we have to do that by cutting benefits. Look, Social Security has a cap right now where you collect taxes on $113,000 or $118,000. Social Security is a system we created because it reflects our values as a country, that when you reach a certain age or you have a certain disability, that you be guaranteed to have the security of knowing your basic needs could be met. We should be sure that we protect that and strengthen it for many generations. There's an easy way to do it. You lift that cap so that, in fact, someone who makes $5 million doesn't have $4,900,000 exempt from taxation. If you do that, you extend the life of Social Security for 75 years.
How about changing the eligibility in terms of age?
No, look. Why not? Because, look, it's easy to say if you work in a university and you
there
sit behind a desk.
There are exceptions for
you
labor.
You work in a resin factory. I was in a resin factory, people who do working on boats. By the time they're 68, they are spent. They can't work another year. So the reality is, what I think we need to be looking at is making sure that the system is strengthened and reformed. But, you know, Social Security used to be one leg of a three-legged stool. You had your private pensions, you had your savings, and you had Social Security. That's less and less the case with many Rhode Islanders and many Americans who rely exclusively on Social Security. It's $14,300 is the average benefit for Rhode Islanders, somewhere in that $14,500. We're talking about people who are barely making it on Social Security. And so we should be protecting it and protecting the benefits, not cutting them.
Let's talk about another national issue. Congress is taking a closer look at immigration reform than it has in years, but the bipartisan Group of Eight, including Republican Senator Marco Rubio, is calling progress premature. Congressman, how confident are you that there will be a deal on immigration?
I think there will be a deal. You know, there's an effort underway in the House. There's an effort underway in the Senate, sort of separately. But I think as a political reality, the Republicans realize they have got to come to the table on this. They will become extinct as a political party if they don't. And I think the question will be, you know, is it strike the right balance, create a path to citizenship for aspiring Americans, require people to go to the end of the line, pay their fines, pass a background check, do all those things. But I think this is the year it will happen.
Maureen, do you share the congressman's optimism on an immigration deal?
I actually do. I think it looks like it's going to happen, and I applaud the Congress, because this could be the one time that you get something done that we can turn to and say it's positive.
Scott, you'd like to talk about the ethnic ballet of immigration. How do you see this issue moving forward?
I guess I'm a little more jaundiced. I still think in the House on the Republican side, it's going to be difficult to get meaningful reform, because a lot of these folks, as you mentioned earlier, are very upset about the fact that they might face a challenge from the right. And the fact is, the base of the party in the South and in the far West, the Republican Party, are a lot of old, cranky white people who see this as a cultural threat to their way of life. And the same thing with guns, unfortunately.
We're almost out of time, but real quickly, Congressman, in terms of the gun issue, how do you respond to gun owners who say that people who commit gun violence don't pay attention to laws, and more stringent laws aren't going to reach those people?
Well, it's like we're saying we shouldn't have laws against murder because people kill people. Look, the reality is we need to have laws, and we need to do everything we can to prevent guns from getting into the hands of criminals and people who are seriously mentally ill. We should have a universal background check to make sure that doesn't happen. We should fix the broken background check system. We should ban these weapons of war, the assault weapons, which discharge, you know, whose only purpose it is to kill a great number of people in a very short period of time. We should close the loopholes of the fire sale, that when you are a licensed gun dealer and you have your license revoked, a federally licensed gun dealer, because you've engaged in misconduct, your inventory is then deemed your personal collection, where you can sell it free from any background checks. I have a bill I've introduced to close that loophole. But look, these are common sense proposals. We should obviously honor people's right to possess a firearm, but we should keep them out of the hands of criminals and people who are seriously mentally ill.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us on Roundtable. Scott?
Thank you.
Maureen.
Thank you.
And Congressman David Cicilline.
Thank you very much.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Robertson Foundation, continuing the commitment of its founder, Stephen Hamblett, to honest government in Rhode Island through in-depth political coverage. And if you enjoy the conversation, please visit our On Politics blog at ripr.org.